Rennie, you were one of only two of the seven remaining defendants to take the stand, and you were on the stand for a long time. What was your purpose in going on the first place?
Well, I think unlike the parade of witnesses we've had, really touching every part of our movement, with a multitude of objectives, perhaps the major one being to try to discredit the court system the way we discredited the political process in 68, and trying to project our politics to the country, especially to young people and to black people. When I took the stand, I thought that it was really a time when a defendant ought to attempt at least to speak to the other America that sort of sits in that jury box, that at least with a jury has gone through an incredible 5-month political experience of their own, but to try to take our politics, our culture, our radicalism, and to present it in a way that was comprehensible to those 14 people that have lived through this experience with us. It's a difficult undertaking, because on the one hand you have to put in very comprehensible terms why it was that the Yippies and the mobilization came to Chicago, what their objectives were, faced with the potential of 500,000 people protesting the war and racism at the amphitheater at the time of the Democratic nomination, Johnson and Humphrey decided to basically suspend the Constitution, roll in the troops and the barbed wire around the amphitheater, and scare away the people with jobs, the people with families, the people who could not afford to be arrested. Why it was that faced with that kind of armed camp, police state buildup, we decided, unlike Allard Lowenstein and the McCarthy supporters and the liberals, not to call off our demonstration, not to discourage people to come, but to urge those people who were willing to face the troops and the bayonets to come on to Chicago anyway. And to say all of that in a way that would get before the jury, given the way Judge Hoffman defines the rules of evidence. Now, the experience of all the witnesses up to my going on the stand showed us that the only way that you can get any evidence into the courtroom is through a fairly stilted kind of a framework where a defendant is in a meeting and a police agent is also represented and has had some testimony about that. And you have to have a conversation in which another defendant is present, and you can then relate in that context who said what. You can't basically testify to very much else. You can't make political speeches. You can't talk about your motivation. You can't talk about what shaped your political thinking, even through the last 10 years, much less, you know, shaping it all the way back to grade school or high school or something of that kind. All of that's inadmissible in this courtroom. So I had to sort of, in preparing, go through the 400 odd meetings I had been involved in leading up through the year to the convention itself, and to choose meetings where essentially I could put together a theory and an analysis and put it together in a way that was basically devoid of movement rhetoric and incomprehensible language to the jury, but it explained in a way that, you know, was totally understandable. At the same time, while we're trying to explain why we came to Chicago, why the mayor reacted the way he did, why it was natural that he would react the way he did, and then why we came on anyway, while doing this, it was also necessary to try to explain to the jury why it was that the government had produced 70-odd undercover agents and police officers who had a totally different view, that our purposes were to dynamite the International Amphitheater, to storm the Conrad Hilton and the like. why in all of the conversations that I was going to testify to, police agents who had been in the same conversations had said that we wanted to kill pigs, we wanted to put people on viaducts, to shoot the shit out of community people. Why it was that the general, you know, why the intelligence came forward in the manner it did, and why even Dave Dellinger's pacifist march to the International Amphitheater on the night of the nomination was, in fact, according to police informers, a diversionary tactic for Tom and me and the crazy people to run wild in the loop with our mill-ins and busting windows and tying up traffic and the rest. So I tried to explain the mentality of the paid police informer, what kind of person he is, to show it's the police informer that's constantly proposing the provocative acts. It's a police informer who's sitting in a meeting and hears certain key words, yanks those words out of context and turns them on their head, and then files a report to the mayor or to whoever. And trying at the same time to, you know, to humanize the whole experience so that you know, a jury that's hardly a jury of our peers, but is a jury of, you know, American middle class and working class people can relate to.
Do you think that your testimony was successful? Did it communicate with the jury? And did it communicate with anybody else?
Well, I think that it was. I think that the jury, as we know, is very divided at this point, very polarized. Any witness that we put on the stand, there's sort of two or three regulars who will listen, pay attention, make open kinds of facial expressions to our witnesses, and the rest of the jury sort of ignores them or looks the other way or looks, you know, down on the floor. My feeling was that by the end of, you know, by the end of my testimony, in large part because I was a defendant, that and really trying to speak to the jury, and not to the press, and not to the defendants, but to the jury, that by the end of my testimony, that, you know, the jury as a whole was attentive and really with me, and at least relating to what I was trying to say, if not fully agreeing.
Did that include Judge Hoffman himself, who at one point you had to stop and wake up?
No, the judge kept falling asleep through a good part of my testimony. It was a lot of interesting observations about the judge. You're sitting only about 4 feet away from the judge, and the judge is absolutely going out of his mind, having this criminal side by side his elbow. When the judge, for example, gets up after the court's in recess, he sort of moves anxiously, cautiously, you know, past you. I'm sort of standing in the witness chair, and the judge has to walk behind me. And the first time I noticed his paranoid was quite by accident. He was walking behind me, and I just sort of turned around and tried to, you know, left right behind him. And the just my sudden motion right behind him so frightened him that he just drove himself right into the wall, and there was sort of this thud against the wall as he reacted to my motion, and then he quickly scampered out of the door. And from that time on, he always made sure that there were two marshals right by the door waiting to pounce on me and put a .45 caliber bullet in my head, I suppose, if I made another similar kind of jerky motion. Other interesting things is how he studies our document. You know, we had Tom and I had written a very long paper describing mobilization plans for the convention and a whole election year offensive in 1968. And in this paper, we were trying to argue with the movement why we thought the militants that could be achieved at the time of the convention was a militance really of numbers rather than small group actions. Of course, as it turned out, it was a small demonstration, and much more militant kind of activity was really called for in Chicago because of the police state conditions that we faced. But at the in the original planning, at least, we had high hopes that it would be massive in numbers, and that the International Amphitheater area would just be paralyzed with hundreds of thousands of people. And we felt that it was essential in order to achieve this number that the demonstration attempt to get a permit, that it be legal, that it be nonviolent, and that more creative kinds of actions be organized on a decentralized basis out of movement centers. And so we argued this in a position paper. Probably the clearest statement of our intent, at least, in coming to Chicago. And the government obviously didn't want the paper given to the jury, and so got up and made some kind of nonsensical legal argument about why it shouldn't be admitted. It was self-serving, I think. Also irrelevant and immaterial and other useful legal points. Then the judge, after he hears the objection from the government, is obligated under the law then to study the document and to consider whether or not, in fact, it is irrelevant, immaterial, or self-serving. So he was sitting there going through this document, and it was fascinating to me because I hadn't realized up until the time I was on the witness stand that he never reads any of these documents. He doesn't even pretend to read the documents. He turns like four pages at a time. His eyes, if you watch his eyes carefully, they sort of start at the top of the paper, then they sort of shoot off to the side of the paper, then all the way onto the floor somewhere, and then back to the page for a few minutes, and another four pages turn over. As I watched this process, I pointed out to the courtroom that the judge hadn't even read the paper, and he got very incensed and ordered a marshal to come over to the witness stand and turn me around so that I wouldn't observe his habits.
This is this whole trial, of course, has been a confrontation like the convention between life forces of the 70s and death forces of the 60s. It's also takes place in what is officially known as an adversary system of law. You met an adversary under the best of circumstances in being cross-examined by Tom Foran for 2.5 days. Who won?
Well, I thought that Foran was a punk and that Foran got his ass kicked. I would really have liked, really, for there to have been more of a man there, to have been more of a person who genuinely believed in what he was doing, or at least had the smarts about what he was trying to do, and thought he was could get away with it. But Foran sort of is this daily hack who I had met several times before the convention. He achieved fame in Chicago by the active involvement in urban renewal. He was directly responsible for the displacement of tens of thousands of black people in this city from their homes. He went on to become the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois. And in many ways, I think Foran had a very important part to play in the formation of this indictment. In fact, he had received direct orders from Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who wanted to testify about this in the courtroom and wasn't allowed to, that he was not to bring on indictments against the demonstrators. He was to investigate police conduct during the demonstrations. And instead, like 3 days after he'd received this order from his own boss, the Attorney General, he followed the orders of his real boss, the mayor, and convened the grand jury and brought the indictments against us. I don't know. I mean, looking at him while he's cross-examining, it was really an incredible experience. He attempts to turn his body and his facial expression into a kind of ferocious animal, snarling and graveling and snorting his questions in a way that's aimed basically at trying to intimidate. And I suppose that, in some courtrooms that might be an effective technique, but the overall impression, I think, was that he was basically just trying to badger and push and shove and really didn't have facts. And after the first hour or so, it really kind of proved to be a bore. It was sort of a bore until really the last hour, when he became very highly political and started screaming at me about my relations with the Vietnamese and my speeches to young people across the country, urging them to spread the mutiny that was started by Company A in South Vietnam and every factory and community and schoolhouse of the country. And wasn't it a fact that I urged young people to carry out activities of insurrection and revolt and so on? And his final question was, and didn't you tell a reporter on August 30th, the day after the convention ended, that we had won America? And my answer to all those questions was basically yes. And I said all those things and was glad of it. And I just would basically buy back all his language and restate it for the jury, giving me really my best opportunity to make a political speech to the jury.
The trial is close to an end, and there are, of course, various possibilities about the verdict and the contempt and the sentence, etc. But within the framework of any of those, coming as it does at the end of a pretty clearly marked 10-year period, and coming to as it does clearly at a transitional point for the white movement, what kind of assessment and advice and recommendation do you have at this point to the movement in general?
To stay out of trials like this one.
Well, what can I tell you about the trial? It's boring a lot. Sometimes it's fun. Sometimes we get to say what needs to be said. A lot of times we don't. Mostly the courts, a weapon in the hands of the government, being used in an ongoing political war against not really us, but who in the fantasies of the government we represent. Sometimes we've been successful in grappling with the government, trying to turn their weapon around on them. Mostly, I guess, we've only been intermittently successful. When we are, it's terrific. And the government falls dead, at least for a little second of time. The judge goes crazy. Ferran, Schultz go mad. But they don't die, they spring up eternal. I guess the trial for me has kind of been a forced performance, not being a publicly noticed exemplary actor like some of my brothers. It's kind of forced me to adopt a style of work which is kind of like accepting the burdens of exemplary action or exemplary actors with not really having the full choice of it all. What I mean by all that is that there's lots of different ways to work in the movement, and my own style has been in the past quiet, organizing, trying to keep my own head straight, trying to stay free, strong as I can be. And while it's always been necessary for some people to be highly visible and take on the joys, certainly there are joys in publicly noticed performances, Jerry, Abby, Tom, Rennie, Dave, burdens are immense. The pressures are great. And I've always felt that that what can be fully accomplished by that, while necessary, is not a kind of accomplishment that I wanted to do. I've had the charming experience while being on trial and running around and talking a lot at different universities and places like that, that kind of magical belief that one time, I guess every organizer has always had, that somehow if you just say the right things in the right place, things will fall into place. and you can leave after a relatively short period of time and leave something for the people to work with, work in. Mostly, I guess, it's struggling to stay alive and feeling, and to make what and carry whatever political message is possible to carry to people, give them some way to relate to the madness that's our trial. And I suppose show them that people can grow up to be past 30 and have made a lot of mistakes and still have long hair and talk like reasonable human beings and enjoy dope and not be embarrassed about knowing as much about shotguns as you do about dope. And I guess the tension in the trial and the consequences of the trial for me has been a kind of conflict in magical thinking. I've always been willing to be magical, but the heavy dependence on magical work of a star-studded performance, trying to bring a word to people, it just kind of goes against my way. You're asking me, Mike, when I say the court is mad, or that the courts themselves are illegitimate, what I kind of mean by that. I guess the madness, the insanity of the court kind of moves along in a lot of different ways. Obviously, the most immediate kind of thing is just the craziness of the participants, us, and more particularly them. But more critically than that, more critically than the looniness of dozens of 6'3" marshals in the courtroom and the kind of glaring insanity out of the judge's eyes about our hair and our disrespect to the court, slouching in our seats, third grade like we're told to sit up straight. The judges, I remember when Rennie finished testifying, we all kind of, Rennie was trying to be cool, you know, and kind of come back and sit down. We couldn't let him. Tom jumped up and hugged him. We all jumped up, touched him, hugged him. The judge screamed out, really, I've never been in a courtroom where there's been so much physical affection displayed. We shouted back, right on. The kind of insanity that's like we produce a witness who come on with a coherent statement about what we believe, what they believe, and the government is overjoyed, and we're overjoyed. We're overjoyed because we've been able to bring in our politics, our lives, our style into the courtroom. The government's overjoyed because we're able to bring in our politics and our style into the courtroom. They see it as a thing that's going to screw us with the jury, and we see it as a thing that's necessary to put before the jury. So the same event will be defined by both sides as, aha, we won that one. It's the day-to-day things, events in the courtroom that make it crazy. For a long time, for years and years, all of us in our guts, the people sitting around that table, as well as the people who are at all interested in the trial, who see it as a real thing, we all of us, and more people even than that, have kind of gotten into our guts the feeling that the courts are somehow, ultimately, through some kind of work, some form of social justice is attainable in the courtroom. And although we don't believe it intellectually in our guts, it's hard not to believe that. And that's a lesson that we learn over and over again in that courtroom. I mean, the judge may be, often may be a caricature, which good liberals will dismiss, who good liberals will dismiss as kind of not representative of the system. And everyone can be, will be sure that somehow, either through a juror's, individual juror's obstinacy, or through some higher court's independent standards, either a verdict against us would be overturned, or perhaps because of that individual juror's obstinacy, no decision against us will be able to be reached in that courtroom. That's possible. Perhaps that's so. But I think that the very fact of submittal, our submittal to that process, is one which I don't necessarily advocate for other people to take. We took that road, show up in court every day, because it was really, as what I was talking about earlier about the burdens of publicly noticed actors, that they have certain kinds of responsibilities, which I don't think everybody has, and I don't think everybody should have. It's very difficult to figure out how to relate constantly to that court process, to that attempted judicial punishment kind of wreaked against us. And that tension, our intellectual and emotional responses and our political responses and those things add attention, add a dimension of madness that's not really fully apparent, I don't think, all the time.
What do I look for at the end of the trial? Put us away. They're going to put us away. I just said, I think that it's possible that we might get a hung jury. More likely, because there are 7 of us and 14 charges altogether, it gives the jury an opportunity to negotiate among themselves. They'll finally walk in back into the jury room after having come out twice and said that they can't reach a decision, the judge constantly sending them back. So they'll sit down in the room, and either the good liberals who are for us or the people who are strongly against us will say, well, look, my God, they can't all be, you know, can't all be innocent, or they can't all be guilty. So who do you think is the most guilty? Who do you think is the most innocent? And they'll start to negotiate. Somebody will be found guilty on both counts. Somebody will be found innocent on, you know, one, maybe both. People will be guilty of one, not guilty of another. Dave might be guilty of conspiracy, but not guilty of his specific inciting act. Rennie might be guilty of an inciting act, but not guilty of conspiracy. You know, it's a negotiated agreement among the jurors. And then we'll go to jail. Go to jail for contempt, go to jail on this charge. I think people's responses will be a lot like people's responses were when Huey was convicted, that if it's clear, if the court had chosen to exercise its full power against Huey, people would have gone mad. People would have responded in aggressive, revolutionary way. The confused 2 to 15, how do you respond to that? Does that mean he's going to get out right away? Of course it didn't. Didn't then, it doesn't now. But people have, even the most corrupt court, even the most brutally oppressive judicial system, retains kind of an aura of hope or possibility in it. And so people respond differentially to our case. I hope very strongly that some people we'll learn from our case that one does not voluntarily submit to planned judicial punishment. I hope some people take that lesson out of our trial. Others will say, all right, it's possible to present some kind of, even in the most restrictive court, it's possible to present some kind of coherent political statement, and sometimes that coherent political statement in a courtroom needs to be made. Those people, to those people, I had the caution that they have to be aware of that, because the people who are indicted in this case, and the style of the indictment, and the event itself that led to the indictment, meant a context, a public media context of this trial, which a lot of trials don't have. I think most particularly of John Sinclair's trial, which a lot of people said then, and I suppose too many people say now, John Sinclair who? I don't know, I think probably most people will end up feeling bad for a while, which is wrong, but that's how they'll, you know, and they'll feel that, well, we'll organize demonstrations and perhaps political pressure in terms of the threatened complete illegitimacy, perceived illegitimacy of the judicial system, will force the judges to free us on some technical thing, some technical thing that happened during the court. Not necessarily overthrowing the law or saying that we were innocent, but they'll find some way to get us out. That may happen. That might happen. It'd be nice if it did. I don't think people should go to prison. It'd be nice if we don't have to go.